Americana.
When I am writing a novel, I must actually live the lives of my characters. If, for instance, my hero is a gambler on the French Riviera, I make myself pack up and go to Cannes or Nice willy-nilly, and there throw myself into the gay life of the gambling set until I really feel that I am Paul Delacroix or Ed Whelan or whatever my hero's name is. Of course, this runs into money, and I'm quite likely to have to change my ideas about my hero entirely and make him a bum on a tramp steamer working his way back to America.
The words you have just heard were written by Robert Benchley in his article, How I Create. This program is Americana, the sixth in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight we bring you Two Literary Lights.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. Last weekend, I had occasion to take a fairly long train ride, and following an old custom, I packed my suitcase with a half dozen new books to read on the way. The books that I read on trains have to be either very light or very good, for the temptation to fall asleep or simply to gaze vacantly out of the window is a considerable one. The first book that I picked up once I got aboard the train was certainly not light in the sense of being trivial or empty of content. On the other hand, it was, as I had expected it to be, a very good book. It was, in fact, Gilbert Hyatt's newest publication, A Clerk of Oxenford. If you don't know Mr. Hyatt, either through his books or his radio broadcasts, I should like to have the pleasure of introducing him to you, despite the fact that he's a competitor as well as a colleague of mine. For more than 15 years, he has been professor of Latin language and literature at Columbia University. He's the author of several distinguished scholarly books, which you may have seen. The Classical Tradition, in my opinion, is one of the best of these. A couple of years ago, Mr. Hyatt came, rather late in his career, to broadcasting. He started a modest series of book programs over a New York station under the title People, Places, and Books. The series proved to be a great success. It may now be heard by transcription on a number of American and Canadian stations, and will soon, I understand, be broadcast in Australia. I'm sure the National Broadcasting Company will forgive me if I urge you to check your local radio listings and see whether Mr. Hyatt's talks are not being broadcast in your neighborhood. If they are, by all means, listen to them, no matter where they're carried. I'm sure that you'll enjoy them. There is, happily, another way in which you may enjoy Mr. Hyatt's programs. Last year, a collection of his talks was published by the Oxford University Press under the title People, Places, and Books. And the new collection, which I mentioned, A Clerk of Oxenford, is a very welcome repetition of the mixture as before. The title of this collection is taken from Chaucer's thumbnail sketch in the prologue to the Canterbury Tales of the Professional Bookworm. You remember, a clerk there was of Oxenford also that unto logic had long ago. This was the chap who would labor have at his bed's head 20 bookers clad in black and red than almost anything imaginable. These lines Mr. Hyatt has translated into modern English to suit his own case.
Here now is one of Oxford's graduates who spent 3 terms on mods and 7 on greats. And he would rather have at his bed's head 20 good books bound in black or red of poetry or of philosophy than a silk shirt or a widescreen TV.
I'm very sure that if you can say amen to these sentiments, you'll enjoy Mr. Hyatt's book. And perhaps even if you cannot, for the Clerk of Oxenford seems to be having a good deal of fun in this book. I think that really is the secret of Hyatt's success as a broadcaster. He presents to his readers and listeners the picture of a man who enjoys books, talking with obvious pleasure about some of the byways in his reading. Now please note that term byways. One of the marks of a genuine book lover is that he doesn't feel obliged to discourse only on the great themes and the literary immortals. He's free to talk about literary trivia and about the minor writings that have given him pleasure. Let me give you an example. One of the most pleasant of the Hyatt essays deals with kitsch. Kitsch, we learn, is anything that takes a lot of trouble to make and is quite hideous.
It's paradoxical stuff, Keats. It's obviously bad. So bad that you can scarcely understand how any human being would spend days and weeks making it and how anybody else would buy it and take it home and keep it and dust it and leave it to their heirs. It's terribly ingenious and terribly ugly and utterly useless. And yet it has one of the qualities of good art, which is that once seen, it is not easily forgotten. Of course, it's found in all the arts. Think of the Milan Cathedral or the statues in Westminster Abbey or Liszt's setting of Schubert's songs. Well, there's a lot of it in the United States. For instance, the architecture of Miami, Florida, and Forest Lawn Cemetery in Los Angeles. Many of Hollywood's most ambitious historical films are superb, Keats. Most Tin Pan Alley love songs are perfect, 100% Keats.
Reading this, I began to think of the possibilities of doing a sort of catalog of Keats in the Chicago area. But don't worry, if I ever carry out the project, I'll lock the manuscript in a bank vault and only allow it to be published posthumously. I really think, though, that my favorite piece of Keats is the work of that unsung genius who thought of manufacturing replicas of the Venus de Milo with a clock set in her stomach. It appears that Hyatt is fascinated by literary Keats, and in fact that he collects it. After time, he introduces us to a Scots poet of the last century, William McGonagall by name, who really deserves to rank in literary history with Julia E. Moore, the sweet singer of Michigan.
One of McGonagall's most intense personal experiences was his visit to New York. Financially, it was not a success. In one of his vivid autobiographical sketches, he says, "I tried occasionally to get an engagement from theatrical proprietors and music hall proprietors, but alas, 'twas all in vain, for they all told me they didn't encourage rivalry." However, he was deeply impressed by the architecture of Manhattan. In eloquent verses, he expressed what many others have felt, although without adequate words to voice their emotion. "O mighty city of New York, you're wonderful to behold. Your buildings are magnificent, the truth be it told. They were the only thing that seemed to arrest my eye, because many of them are 13 stories high. And the tops of the houses are all flat, and the warm weather the people gather to chat. Besides, on the housetops they do dry their clothes, and also many people all nicked on the housetops repose." Yet McGonagall felt himself a stranger in the United States, and here again is his close kinship with Wordsworth. The poet laureate, in a powerful sonnet written at Calais, once reproached the English Channel for delaying his return by one of those too frequent storms in which, reckless tyrant, it will indulge itself. "Why cast ye back upon the Gallic shore, ye furious waves, a patriotic son of England?" And in the same vein, McGonagall sings with rapture of his return to his ain country. "And with regard to New York and the sights I did see, one street in Dundee is more worth to me. And believe me, the morning I sailed from New York for bonny Dundee, my heart it felt as light as a cork."
I may as well be forthright about this. In my opinion, William McGonagall alone is worth the price of Mr. Hyatt's book. But there's a great deal more that you get in the book as sort of a continuing bonus. I particularly enjoyed the discussion of invective as a literary form and a very interesting note on double talk. But I suppose the essay on parody, appropriately entitled A Bouquet of Poison Ivy, is really as good as anything in the book. Or perhaps I like it because Hyatt lists as the four most consistently successful parodists of today Wolcott Gibbs, S.J. Perelman, James Thurber, and E.B. White. I can say a hearty amen to those sentiments, too, and particularly to this passage.
Thurber is famous, yet few of us realize, until we read his parodies, how many different styles he can travesty. Here's a brief specimen in the energetic manner of James Cain. "I walked close to her. It was like dying and going to heaven. I reached over and let her have one on the chin, and she went down like a tray of dishes. I knew then that I'd be beating her up the rest of my life. It made me feel like it was April. And I was a kid again, and it was all misty outdoors. And the birds were singing. Frankly, my own favorite of these four is S.J. Perlman, partly because he's more fantastic than the others, and, well, partly because, like Hemingway's Matadors, he works much closer to the bull. He can achieve a parody in only one or two sentences. For instance, he once dreamed up a highbrow quarterly called Spendthrift, and in which he said that he was following a serial called Mysticism in the Rationalist Cosmogony, or John Dewey Rides Again. In the previous number, Perlman says the cattle rustlers, post-Hegelian dogma, had dropped Dewey in an abandoned mine shaft, Jamesian pragmatism, and had ignited the fuse leading to a keg of dynamite, neo-Newtonian empiricism. In the same volume, Perlman outlined a modern ballet called Six Who Pass While the Concrete Boils, in which half a dozen stocky Bryn Mawr girls in gray jerseys stride convulsively from one end of the stage to the other, tugging at a veil. This symbolizes the forces of water, sand, and Portland cement, at first refusing to work harmoniously and then uniting for the common good.
I was so delighted at these remarks by Mr. Hyatt, for in my opinion, the collected works of Perelman and Thurber will outlast Bronze, and if they don't, there's no justice in the world, that it was only somewhat later that they reminded me of a conviction I have held for many years. Well, a year anyway. This is that literary critics need to replenish their supply of masterworks. The great literary figures of this century and the last one have been pretty well worked over. Joyce has no mysteries left to unveil. College sophomores will explain Finnegan's Wake to you in the 10 minutes between classes. Melville's fishy symbols have all been dipped in formaldehyde and mounted on the collector's board. And the explications of Hemingway's work are now much bulkier than the work itself. In a phrase which seems somehow familiar, it's time for a change. And I can think of few better writers to elevate to the status of modern master than Sidney J. Perelman. Perelman's first book was entitled Dawn Ginsburg's Revenge. This was published in 1929. The big bull market collapsed shortly afterward, but Perelman didn't. He has survived the crash, the depression, a brace of wars, and is still publishing. In a critical introduction to the modern library edition of Perelman's work, a man named Sidney Namerlep says of him,
"In any consideration of S.J. Perelman, and S.J. Perelman certainly deserves the same consideration one accords old ladies on streetcars, babies traveling unescorted on planes, and the feeble-minded generally, it's important to remember the crushing, the well-nigh intolerable odds under which the man has struggled to produce what may well be, in the verdict of history, the most picayune prose ever produced in America, denied every advantage and beset and plagued by ill fortune and a disposition so crabbed as to make Alexander Pope and Dr. Johnson seem sunny by contrast. He's nevertheless managed to belt out a series of books, each less distinguished than its predecessor. His work is a museum of mediocrity, a monument to the truly banal. What Flaubert did to the French bourgeois in Beauvoir and Pécuchet, what Pizarro did to the Incas, what Jack Dempsey did to Paulino Uskoden, S.J. Perelman has done to American literature."
I can't feel that this criticism is anything but one-sided. In Perelman's defense, we must remember that he's written a lot, that his work is frequently weird enough to provide critics with some fine opportunities for interpretation, and that the topics which he has attacked, and I use the term advisedly, are many and varied. For example, neither Eric Ambler nor the had-I-but-known school of mystery writers will ever seem the same to me after Perelman's fog-shrouded tale called, somewhat obscurely, Nestle Road to Jeopardy.
Whenever I turn over the whole grotesque affair in my mind, trying to rationalize the baffling complex of events that overtook me on the French Riviera this autumn, I always ask myself the same questions. What would have happened if destiny, unpredictable jade, had drawn my laggard feet to some hotel other than Villa Heliotrope? What if Anglo-Saxon shyness had sealed Colin Rentschler's lips and he had not impulsively come to the aid of a fellow American in hazard?
Would I ever have met that elegant assassin, Colonel Firdowsi of the Turkish secret police, or cowered in the hold of a rusty Greek steamer bound for the Piraeus, or given chase at midnight to a music hall juggler over the roofs of Montparnasse? In short, in my mind, why should I, timid recluse, have been wantonly singled out for supporting a role in the nightmare of a fantastic thing such as the riddle of the cheesecloth bag, a problem to shame the wildest conceits of an Eric Ambler or a Carol Reed? And why, except that it is highly traditional, do I ask these questions all over again when I should be getting on with my story? To begin at the beginning, I'd been down at Fez in North Africa all summer, working on a book of favorite recipes of famous people like Tennessee Williams, Paul Bowles, Truman Capote, and Speed Lamkin. And my nerves were at sixes and sevens. And I felt completely drained, used up. I'd pretty well exhausted my emotional bank balance doing the necessary research, and I knew it was a touch and go unless I immured myself in some quiet pied-a-terre where I could slough off superficialities and organize my material. Well, I shan't burden you with tedious autobiographical details, but perhaps I ought to explain that my people, poor bourgeois dears, left me a goodish bit of money. Not that money's actually vital to my existence, mind you. One art I've mastered is how to make do with the absolute minimum. Given fair seats at the ballet, half a dozen friends with country houses from whom I can scrounge weekends, a few custom-tailored suits, some decent hand-lasted shoes. Now, it's weakness, I know. But I'm fixated on good leather. And 3 months a year at Montreux or Bordighera, well, I can live in a hole in the wall at Crillon and rub along on a gigot and a crisp salad, if you please.
It would hardly be fair even to hint at the nature of the strange tale Perelman's hero has to tell. You can find the whole eerie affair set down in a recent collection of Perelman pieces called The Ill-Tempered Clavichord. Like a good many other people, I often feel in the mood to say a few bitter things about Hollywood and motion pictures. I'm not sure, however, that Hollywood has ever needed or deserved the Perelman treatment. I say this despite the fact that Perelman at one time was deliberately employed to write motion picture scenarios. My guess is that his employers didn't realize what they were getting into. One indirect result of the Perelman hegira to Hollywood has been a small sheaf of vitriolic sketches of films and filmmaking. My favorite one out of this collection is entitled Scenario. In this one, Perelman gives you a short treatment of practically every movie you've ever seen.
Fade in. Exterior, grassy knoll, long shot. Above the scene, the thundering measures of Unsupe's light cavalry overture. Plains of Abraham, Austerlitz, Vicksburg, the Little Big Horn, Cambrai. Steady on, old son. It's Yorktown. Under a blood-red setting sun, yon proud crest is Cornwallis.
Blood and hounds, proud sirrah, dost brush so lightly past an exciseman of the crown? No quarter, eh?
Oh, laugh, you inhuman monster. Laugh, they call the crowd. Old Pogo lies dead, with only a bareback rider's spangle to mark his grave and a seat for every child in the public schools.
But why are you looking at me in that strange way, Tony? Tony, I'm afraid of you.
Oh, you utter, contemptible, despicable cad! Get out!
Oh, Mumsy, I want to die.
But in the great tangled garden sits a forlorn, tragic-eyed figure, the face a mask of carved ivory. The woman nobody knows, Tilly Bergstrom. What lies behind her shattered romance with Grant Snavely, idol of American flaps?
All right, turn him over, you punks. I'll stay on this set till I get it right. All right, cheese it, Nippers. The jig is up. Long live the jig. Ring out the old, ring in the new.
For love belongs to everyone. The best things in life are free.
This is probably enough to give you some notion of why I'm prepared to introduce a large bust or even an equestrian statue of Perelman into my personal literary hall of fame. I see no reason to spend additional time in writing critical appreciations of James Joyce or James Jones, Virginia Woolf or Thomas Wolfe while Perelman's available. But perhaps I'm prejudiced. Let me go on now to suggest another literary master whose works would enliven most textbook anthologies of literature. I refer to Robert Benchley. Mr. Benchley's death some years ago was a sad blow to the thousands who knew him personally, or through his writings, or through his appearances on radio and in motion pictures. To enjoy Benchley, of course, you have to have a fondness for what I may call, with apologies to Gilbert and Sullivan, innocent merriment. Benchley was a rare bird among humorists, for most humor at bottom springs out of bitterness, and there was no bitterness in Benchley. He had a keen sense of the ridiculous. His essays usually expose the pompous idiocies in which most of us collaborate so soberly every day. But he never seemed to attack this folly. He rather went along with it, enjoyed it, and in the long run inflated ordinary follies to such size that their essential ridiculousness was revealed. Well, there'll be no new Benchley essays, and to anyone who grew up, as I did, on such books of his as Love Conquers All, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, or David Copperfield, and After 1903, what? That seems a great pity. But there are some minor consolations. One is that Mr. Benchley's son, Nathaniel, has come forward with a new collection of the best of his father's work, entitled The Benchley Roundup. Nathaniel Benchley's taste, I must say, seems to me quite good. At least he has included in his collection that remarkable contribution to natural philosophy, The Social Life of the Newt.
It is not generally known that the newt, although one of the smallest of our North American animals, has an extremely happy home life. It's just one of those facts which never get bruited about. I first became interested in the social phenomena of the newt life early in the spring of 1913, shortly after I had finished myself in researches in sexual differentiation among amoeba. Well, since that time, I've practically lived among newts, jotting down observations, making lantern slides, watching them in their work and in their play, and you may rest assured that the little rogues have their play, as who doesn't? Until from much lying in a research posture on my stomach over the enclosure in which they were confined, I found myself developing what I feared might be rudimentary creepers. And so, late this autumn, I stood erect and walked into my house, where I immediately set about the compilation of the notes that I had made. Well, so much for the non-technical introduction. The remainder of this article bids fair to be pretty scientific.
And so it is, very scientific indeed. No reader of the Benchley Roundup, except perhaps those who read simply as a frivolous pastime, can fail to be impressed by the range of the master's interests. You've just sampled the work of Benchley the scientist. Now here, in a keenly introspective paper on how I create, is Benchley the literary man.
In an article on How Authors Create, in which the writing methods of various masters of English prose like Conrad, Shaw, and Barrie are explained, with photographs of them in knickerbockers, plaguing dogs, and pushing against sundials, I discovered that I've been doing the whole thing wrong all these years. Now, when I'm writing a novel, I must actually live the lives of my characters. If, for instance, my hero is a gambler on the French Riviera, I make myself pack up and go to Cannes or Nice willy-nilly, and there I throw myself into the gay life of the gambling set until I really feel that I am Paul de la Croix or Ed Whalen or whatever my hero's name is. Now, of course, this sometimes runs into money, and I'm quite likely to have to change my ideas about my hero entirely, make him a bum on a tramp steamer working his way back to America. Perhaps a young college boy out of funds who lives by his wits until his friends at home send him $100 or $10. One of my heroes, Dick Markwell, in Love's How Do You Do, after starting out as a man about town in New York who never showed his liquor and was apparently an indestructible machine just devoted to pleasure, he had to be changed. Changed to a patient in the trembly ward of a local institution whose old friends didn't recognize him and, furthermore, didn't want to. But as you would doubtless remember, it was a corking yarn.
Now, how, I ask, has it been possible for literary scholars and critics to ignore Benchley's possibilities? but ignored he has been, at least in academic circles. Instead, as Nathaniel Benchley points out, the evaluation of the Benchley essays has been left to untrained persons, such as Air Force sergeants, who have applied quite inadequate criteria to the work.
One time during the recent war, an Air Force sergeant accosted Robert Benchley in a bar, and with little or no preamble said, "I might as well tell you, Mr. Benchley, that I don't like your work." Benchley replied that he had moments of doubt himself, and the sergeant then explained that he had hitched a ride from Africa to Italy in a cargo plane, and that the only available sleeping space had been on bags that were just full of overseas editions of Benchley's books. By the time they passed Sicily, the man said, he was so stiff and sore that he hoped never to hear the name Benchley again. "Try it yourself sometime," he concluded. "That stuff isn't funny when you have to sleep on it."
Now, surely I needn't point out that even as literary criticism goes, this is quite unfair. Where would Shakespeare or Tolstoy or Mickey Spillane be if we insisted on judging their works according to their mattress-like quality? It seems to me, indeed, that all fair-minded persons should join with me in demanding that Benchley and Perelman receive the critical acclaim they have so long merited. After that, let's see what we can do about Thurber and Frank Sullivan and Wolcott Gibbs and possibly H. Allen Smith. And after that, well, it seems to me that Gilbert Hyatt probably has the right idea.
Finally, an intelligent and wealthy publisher, all publishers ought to be very wealthy and most are intelligent, they'd actually commission new parodies in order to fill out the list. For example, we need a parody of MacLeish and a parody of Thomas Mann, doubtless called Mann and Obermann, and one of Sartre entitled Sartre Resartus, and one of André Gide, which would surely be called La Nature Déteste le Gide, or perhaps Gide the Obscene. Then we could find some eminent authors who appear to be making a parody of themselves. Dare I mention Mr. Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom? But enough of this. As the Irish judge said when he was passing sentence on a local criminal, "Sure, and if this pig-stealing continues, none of us will be safe."
You have been listening to Americana, the sixth in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by Ralph Knowles. Music supervision by Maurice Freetmatter, and engineering by John Finnemore. The quoted materials were read by myself, Bill Grisky. The books mentioned on tonight's program included Gilbert Hyatt, The Clerk at Oxenford, published by the Oxford University Press, S.J. Perelman's The Ill-Tempered Clavichord, published by Simon & Schuster, The Best of S.J. Perelman, published by the Modern Library, and The Benchley Roundup, edited by Nathaniel Benchley, and published by Harper & Brothers. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, send your name and address on a postcard to Americana, care of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is NBC Radio.